The subject for this evening's talk, something I can't really resist talking about, it's the subject of non-self, anatta. And so this is, you can regard this as the big chance to become enlightened, because this is the heart of it all. And it also, it carries on from the series of talks which I've been giving. I did not plan the series of talks, it just seems to evolve in its natural order. And this particular talk, the teaching of non-self, is carrying on from the talk which I gave yesterday evening about the stages of enlightenment. Because this is what the enlightenment experience really means. It's discovering the truth of not-self, and at the same time the truth of suffering and impermanence. It does actually seem to be that the actual enlightenment experiences are the uncovering of the anatta doctrine, the anatta idea, especially the first enlightenment experience of Sri Mantra. It seems that one cannot truly accept the depth of dukkha, of suffering, until one has seen anatta first, simply because that the sense of self will always demand some happiness for itself and will not be ready to admit the depth and the breadth of suffering, of dukkha, will not be able to admit the depth of impermanence, and would not be able to understand when the Buddha was talking about such things as cessation. If you look in the Pali Canon, the teachings of the Buddha, the suttas, you start to see that the Buddha said that people who are obsessed with the pleasures of the world can't even, and have no idea of anatta, can't even like conceive of the idea that like all sankharas can be stilled, that there can be a complete ending of all attachments, the destruction of craving, that there can be dispassion, cessation, nibbana. And each of those terms was like a synonym, all meaning the same thing, going from the end, nibbana, the same as cessation, nirodha, the same as like dispassion, the same as the destruction of all craving, the same as the abandoning of all attachment, and the same as the stilling of all sankharas, of all conditioned things. That's actually the word in Pali, is that sabba is all sankharas, samatha. The samatha ing, the tranquilizing, the coming to stillness of all sankharas. And all the sankharas are the five khandhas, stilling it, stilling the consciousness. And the idea that even this consciousness can come to cessation is a really weird and sometimes inconceivable for someone who has an idea of what the anatta doctrine is. Not only is it inconceivable, but it's also quite repugnant. You know, is this all that the practice is about? Just cessation, going into nothingness? However, to understand this goal of Buddhism called Nibbana, and to be able to glimpse nibbana and gain these enlightened experiences, we have to understand the big barrier of the illusion of self. So, how do we go about uncovering this illusion of self, this great mirage which is so difficult to find and to uncover and find the real truth? The practice of meditation is a great help, as I've been mentioning again and again for the past, don't know how many days it is so far we've been on this retreat, that the practice which we're doing here of quietening the mind, being able to sustain awareness, getting like what we call samadhi, and being able to sustain awareness, is a precursor. It's strengthening the mind, it's the preliminary activities which overcome the five hindrances, give the ability for the mind to pursue an investigation which holds the objects long enough, firmly enough, in order to find its essence, find its truth. And the way of inquiry, above all, which leads to uncovering the Dhamma, what the Buddha taught, is the inquiry into non-self. Now that inquiry into non-self is often done in an unmethodical way, in a way which doesn't lead to its source, in a way which actually carries with it some wrong assumptions which prevent the goal being reached. And very often you find that some people inquire into the anatta doctrine using the inquiry like, who am I? Now, who is this in here? And the inquiry, who am I, will not be able to uncover anatta. And I'll give you a simile to indicate this. It's a simile of the Loch Ness Monster. Assume that there is no Loch Ness Monster. That's the truth of the matter. How can you prove it? If you go around looking for the Loch Ness Monster in this little lake up in Scotland somewhere, then you send submarines down there, sonic probes down there, divers down there. You can search that deep and huge lake for 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years with every piece of equipment you can imagine. But just because you haven't found it in all those years does not prove that it's not there. It may be that it's just you've looked in the wrong place. Or maybe you just missed it, or maybe it's been hiding in some underwater cave or whatever. The fact that you don't find it will never convince you it's not there. In fact, usually what happens, the only way that search for the Loch Ness Monster can end is when you see something, or you can see it was something and say, oh, that must be it, and so you found it. It's only when you find a Loch Ness Monster that the search for the Loch Ness Monster ends. That's like the search, who am I, who am I, who am I? Doesn't matter how deeply and how much you search, that you will never be able to find and prove that there's no one there with that sort of inquiry. In fact, it usually ends up with taking something which is very subtle and just giving it the benefit of the doubt and saying, ah, this must be I, this must be me. It is the mistake of the Upanishadic teachers who said, Tatwangazi, that is I, that is me. Or even Descartes, I think that I am. It's a subtle illusion which they're taken to be real. So the search, who am I, you will find will not be sharp enough to be able to dig out the truth. It carries an assumption. It carries the assumption, I am something. It's just, I'm trying to find exactly what I am. That's the who am I quest. But in Buddhism, in the way the Buddha taught, you don't look at anatta that way. You don't search in that direction. That is not yonisamanasikara. It is not the work of the mind which will go to the source of things. That's the philosophical approach. The Buddha's approach was practical. Instead of saying, who am I? He asked you to inquire, what do I take myself to be? What do I perceive myself to be? What do I think myself to be? What do I view myself to be? And that inquiry is the inquiry which produces the results. Because without searching in far-off places for the self, one searches in one's perceptions, one's thoughts, one's views. And to see how when these arise before one's mindfulness, one can see that now and again there is a self assumed. One perceives a self. One thinks of a self. One views a self. It's the illusion which we're looking at. The reality of the illusion. Just like a mirage of a lake in the desert. That mirage is real. Only that we're misinterpreting it. There is actually light, coming. And, the mirage looks blue, and it is blue. It's not a fantasy. I can see it, another person standing next to me can see it. The point is, with a mirage, that we're thinking it's a lake of water, when in fact it's just a reflection of the sky. So when we're looking at the self-illusion, we're looking at the illusion, that which we take to be self, that which we take to be I, me, and mine, in these three areas of perception, thoughts, and view. You can start with view, which is the broadest category and the most stable of categories. Now, who do you view yourself to be? And that becomes the inquiry. We look upon the gross assumptions of a self, first of all, about your nationality, your age, your gender. And bit by bit, as we make this inquiry, we should have enough Yoni Samanasikara, going to the source of things, and enough honesty, enough wisdom to be able to discard many of these self-assumptions which can cause people to fight for a country, to be upset at jokes about gender, to be upset about their age or concerned about it. We can go deeper into our body. Do you take the body to be yourself? And remember that simile which the Buddha gave. If you assume the body to be the self, then you'll be concerned about it. If you don't assume the body to be a self, then it's just like the leaves and the twigs in the Jeta Grove. If someone heaped them up, burnt them, when the ashes were cold, throw them up into the four winds so they got dispersed all over the place, you wouldn't be so concerned, because those leaves and twigs aren't yours. They don't belong to you. They're not I, they're not me, they're not mine. If one regarded the body in the same way, you would not mind the mosquitoes biting you. You would not mind the aches and pains which come and go according to the nature of the body. You'd not be so concerned about the aging process of the body, and you would not be at all concerned about the death of the body, because you never identify with the body. You never take this body to be I, me, mine. You don't take it to be yourself. The teachers in Thailand, the forest teachers, they always make such a great big deal about the first Satipatthana, about the mindfulness connected with the body. And the reason they do this is because that even though that we may think intellectually that I don't assume the body to be me or mine, that at least I know intellectually that I've got to die, that I've got to leave this body alone. This is not my first birth, it's not my last birth. Sometimes that we don't see deeply enough to the point that actually very often we do view the body as I, me, mine. My possession, part of me. And it's because of that that the teachers in Thailand always used to ask their disciples to really make much at the very beginning of the mindfulness of the body. And actually, if you're talking about the Satipatthana, the four foundations of mindfulness, in particular the first foundation of mindfulness, or the mindfulness of the body, sometimes that people can understand what the practice is, but they forget what its purpose is. Why do we do this? And if you read very carefully the Satipatthana Sutta in the Pali, you see the purpose is written there, plain for everyone to see, but it's very rarely emphasized by the teachers or by the monks or whoever. It's said actually in there, you do all of this, all of the practice of meditation, of mindfulness of the body, for one reason and for one reason alone. So that you just know this is body, and not a self, not a me, not a mine. You do the mindfulness to the extent that you know this is just body. If you can remember the Satipatthana Sutta where that phrase occurs. And for the feeling, you do all of that just to know, or just to the extent that the knowledge, this is just Vedana, this is just feeling. You do the the recollection, the mindfulness of mind, of citta, which includes the perceptions and thoughts, just to the extent that you realize this is all it is, just mind, just perceptions and thoughts. It's not me, not mine, not an I. And the same with consciousness. You're mindfully aware of consciousness just to the extent that the knowledge that this is not I, this is not me, this is not mine, arises in you. So that you live unconcerned, detached from the things of the world. This was the point of the Satipatthana, which is very rarely stressed. So when we're looking at the body, what do I take to be myself? We have to look in the body to the extent that we disassociate it with these terms, I, me, or mine. And to dissociate it from those terms, we have to see what do we take as I, me, or mine with regards to the body. And use the faculty of intelligence, use the investigation that whatever part of the body is impermanent, and that's pretty simple to know. This cannot be I, me, or mine. That which is impermanent cannot be a self and cannot belong to a self. That's a very important point. And when we're talking about self or soul, atta, the very meaning of that term requires certain properties. A self has to be permanent, has to be stable. That's the meaning of the term. It's an essence. The change of something is, it's not an essential, not a fundamental fact. Whatever changes, you can usually break down into parts. You find that essence which is behind it all, that which doesn't change. And it's finding the self, finding the core, finding the essence. If it is the essence, it has to be something which is unchanging. And if you understand what the meaning of self is, the meaning of a soul, it's similar to the meaning of a God. A God which changes doesn't make sense. A self, a soul which changes, doesn't make sense. It's like a God which evolves or grows or gets smarter as the centuries roll by, and it doesn't make sense. That shows that he's fallible. But a self, a soul, has to be something which was there yesterday, here today, the same next week, the same next lifetime. Something which doesn't change. So if you see anything or any factor which you are taken to be a self or a soul, a me or a mind, which is changing, that should be enough to prove to you, to show you, this cannot be the self which I'm assuming. If it's not impermanence which would break the illusion, it's the sense that it's suffering. The idea that your essential self is dukkha, again, is anathema to to the very idea of a self or soul. If your essential self is dukkha, you're stuck with something which doesn't change, which is going to be dukkha forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. This is the essential self, the essential soul. And it cannot be that way. Even the all ideas in all religions and philosophies of a self or soul, it's always a blissful, a happy self or soul essence. Not a sort of a miserable one. That would really be a cosmic joke. a very bad taste. But anyhow, so if one looks at any aspect of the body and finds that it's impermanent or is suffering, then you should know that this cannot be yourself, it cannot be me or mine. And one uses this investigation to eradicate all view, all perception, all thought that this body can be a self, can be a me, can be a mine. Not only does a self just exist, not only does the idea of a self exist, but whatever exists is also defined by its purpose, by its function. So something I was mentioning, I think, yesterday, and something which the Buddha pointed out, and I think other philosophers point out. And sometimes to know what a thing is, instead of to look and try and find what it's made of, what its shape and size and constituents and colour or essence is, very often we can get more knowledge, more understanding of a thing, not by what it is, but by what it does, by its function, by its purpose. In the case of the self, the inner being, the essential being, that the purpose of the self, you should know, is to, what it actually does, what its function is to control. Very often you can understand a self, or one of the illusions of self, is this like control of this manager at some sort of switchboard inside the mind. This is just a metaphorical switchboard, which decides when you want to speak and what you want to speak, which decides when you want to move, when you want to scratch and when you want to sit still, which decides what you want to think about and what you don't want to think about, which decides how to enter jhana and how long to enter jhana and how to come out again afterwards. This controller. And you can see that in all times where you assume a self, it's a self which does, which controls, and which possesses. Just like human beings, all human beings, all beings actually, all animals, or insects, ghosts, devas, brahmas, all beings in the realm of existence, all have that same function, to control, to possess. It controls its immediate environment, however big that environment is. That exercise of control is manifested as desire for that which it feels pleasant or safe or secure, and aversion, pushing away that which threatens its security, its well-being, its longevity or whatever, or its ability to procreate and continue its species. This is like the desire and aversion which we know, which you can see in all animals, all beings. That desire and aversion also seeks to possess, possessions which will afford it security, which will afford it happiness, and which will ward off any dangers in future. And the self, the sense of self, is exactly the same. It's the essential part of you which controls, which possesses. And once you start to look at the function of self, what it does, you can start to again see if you take this body to be mine, to be yours. Do you view, do you perceive, do you think of this body as your possession, as something which in the sense that you own? If it's something which you own, you're very concerned about. For example, that sound in the distance, that might be the alarm of a car. If that's your car, you're concerned about it. If it's someone else's car, it's someone else's problem. What you own creates your concern. What you don't own, you can let go of. In the same way that if you regard the body by way of perception, thought or view as mine, you will be concerned about it. You will be attached to it. You'll have desires and aversions concerning it. You'll be caught up with it. You'll become a burden. However, one should understand through yonisamanasikara, through the work of the mind which goes to the source of things, that this body cannot be yours. If it was yours, you'd be able to control it, you'd be able to command it, you'd be able to work it so it never gets sick, so it never hurts. The contemplation of the body is a contemplation which realizes the body goes according to its own natural laws, and you have very little influence in truth, that you can not control it according to your will. It gets old, it gets sick, it dies, it has pains, it has aches. It gets sleepy when you want to meditate. When you lay down at night, you can't go to sleep, you've got too much energy. It does crazy things sometimes, completely beyond your control. If you can regard and contemplate this body, that this is not yours, then again, it's bringing up the detachment, it's bringing up the release from the delusion of self, of the physical body. The result of that is your concern about health, longevity, and physical happiness lessens until it disappears altogether. Your fear of pain and your fear of death also disappears. You're free of a burden, the burden of attachment to this physical body. If you cannot see the body as not self and not mine, neither a self nor belonging to a self, then you cannot really proceed deeper into the things of the mind, because excuse me, the self view, the illusion of self for many people is with the body, and if they cannot let that one go, they cannot go into the deeper, to dig deeper into the illusion and find the illusions in the mind. Again, with the mind, using the four satipatthanas, one goes first of all to feeling, to physical sensation, the happy feelings, the unhappy feelings, which arise through all the six sense doors, pleasures and pain of bodily touch, beauty and ugliness of sight, nice sounds, the birds chirping in the morning, rotten sounds like the alarm going off in the distance. All of these attributes of sensory experience, of pleasurable or painful, is what we mean by vedana. And the Buddha said that in the Satipatthana, the second Satipatthana, we should contemplate this to such an extent that we do not regard this as being me or being mine. Again, sometimes that we can assume that very pleasurable feeling to be mine, to be me even. Very often, one of the dangers of jhana meditation to people who aren't trained in the Dhamma of the Buddhism is to take those very blissful, pleasurable feeling in jhana as being your essential self. When you experience one of these blissful states of mind called the jhanas, everything is powerful, peaceful, blissful, nothing is lacking. very often that people, and people have in the past, have assumed, this is me, this is the union with Brahma, the union with God. I am God, the Atman and the Brahman are one. And again, this is like the illusion of the early Upanishadic tradition. The experience was real of these recluses in the forests of India, but they assumed this Vedana, this feeling, to be their essential self, which somehow got tainted and covered up with the dirt of ordinary experience. And when they came out of the jhana and in, back into the world, back with the body, it was as if that the essential self got hidden behind this murk, this staining of experience. And they thought that there was some sort of original essential mind which they could go back to in these jhanas, and that was their true self. It was identifying with what is essentially Vedana, a sensation, a feeling of being my ultimate self. And the Buddha said that very often you can do this. You can think, now it's right, now I'm happy, and this is the true me. The happy, the content, the pleasurable part of our experience. And this is part of the mind which the Buddha said you should know cannot be a self, nor can it belong to a self. If it was a self, the Buddha was arguing, it's just so easy to see that the feelings change. They come and go, they're anicca. And because of that, you cannot logically, rationally, reasonably say to yourself, I take the feelings to be me, to be I. Because once the pleasurable feelings go, where does I go? You cannot identify with the feelings. Nor can you take the pleasurable feelings as a function of a self. Doesn't belong to a self. It's not what a self does to feel. Because if the self was the one which was doing the feeling, which was in control of the feelings, then it would just feel pleasurable sensations again and again and again. It would never feel pain. Can you, can anyone, can even the Buddha maintain just pleasurable feelings and no unpleasurable, no painful feelings? It's irrational, it's illogical, but sometimes the desire born of illusion is so great that many members of our so-called rational human family believe that after death they can go to a heaven realm which lasts forever and which is just happy feeling, happy sensation, again and again, forever and ever and ever. Anyone who has any knowledge of the mind knows that that has to be impossible. That happiness and suffering are a duality. They rest on one another. That happiness is just a gap between two painful experiences. Painful experience is just a gap between two happy experiences. No more. Vedana is just, or feeling is just like the day and night of sensation. And you cannot have one without the other. It is essentially impermanent. So it cannot be me, and it cannot be mine, because I cannot control it. What is mine, what I possess, is what I can order around. So the person who investigates with sustained mindfulness the arising and passing away of feeling, the arising and passing away of feeling, would not regard it as the home of the ego, the I, the atta, nor would it regard Vedana as belonging in any way to the atta, to the self. It wouldn't be mine. Again, it would just be like the twigs and the leaves in the jeta grove. Because they're not yours, you can disregard them. You can just allow painful and pleasant feelings to just come and go according to their own laws and nature. You detach as soon as you see these things, not I, not me, not mine. Because at a very subtle level, we assume the feelings to be a self or belonging to a self, so we get blown around by them. So we get concerned and attached to them. And so we spend our life searching for more happy feelings and trying to get rid of the unhappy feelings, and only gaining more frustration. Not understanding that we have forgotten the investigation. What do I take myself to be? What do I take as mine? So, in this investigation, one investigates first the body, and when the investigation bears its results, one just casts away the body as being your concern, as being a self or mine. Investigate Vedana, sensation, feeling. You cast it away as not being your concern, not being an I, not being a mine. Then you go into the really interesting areas, you know, the citta, the mind and consciousness. Because those areas, the body and the feelings, that's pretty easy to deal with. Now you go in the body and the mind and the consciousness. Of course, if you're going to investigate mind and consciousness, you have to know what they are, first of all. It's only those people who've done some meditation, who've spent enough time looking inside, knowing the territory, can have some clue about what we mean by consciousness. Not just as some weird idea, intellectual idea, but as the experience of consciousness, its activity as it arises and passes away, as you observe it, with sustained, clear mindfulness, free of the hindrances. You start to see and understand through sustained mindfulness, free of the hindrances, about perception, which I've been talking so much about during this retreat, and also the other mental activities, such as thinking, such as willing, such as the activity of mindfulness itself. You can be mindful of mindfulness and understand what it is. It's only through looking at these, sustaining your attention on these, you know, being free from the perversions and distortion caused by the hindrances, that one can understand what this we take to be the mind, what actually is the mind, what its activity is, what its territory is. And again, that you should know by now, just towards the not the end yet, but towards the latter part of this retreat, just how subtle perception can be and how fascinating, how it is a great area of reality which few people really bother to investigate for themselves. Now, perception can be amazing, that you can take what the Buddha used to do. You can take the perception of night and create such light in his mind that he can, that night becomes day. He can change the whole perception around. He can take the perception of pain and put it into bliss. You can do anything with perception once you know how it works. In any experience, there is such a range of perceptions, like a buffet, like a smorgasbord. And you can just choose whatever you like. From one conscious experience, there's so many perceptions available. However, the unmindful person doesn't see this, and they just, the defilements choose the perception which arises in the mind, not wisdom. The person who has the control of the perception can look upon, say, a brick in the wall and see something more beautiful than a Van Gogh painting. Or they can look upon a beautiful sunset, you know, and see something just, or they can look upon, say, a beautiful woman, a model, and see something really disgusting. A person who knows about perception can do this. However, this is just examples of how perception works, how it arises, and how little ordinary people know about perception and the mental activities and consciousness itself. Once you have some familiarity with the territory of the mind, then you can start to do the investigation, not beforehand, when you know what you're investigating. Then you can start the investigation. What in this realm do I take to be a self, or do I take to be mine? And this is where it gets really interesting, because it's not a philosophical inquiry, it's an experiential inquiry. Because as you experience the territory of the mind, you find yourself viewing certain aspects of this territory as either being mine or actually being the self. Once you can see the vagaries of perception and how it can be manipulated, in the sense that sometimes you can see this if you train yourself, sometimes you can see something else according to causes, not according to will, you can start to see that this perception is very unstable, very impermanent, very uncertain. And never will you take this perception to be anything true. The Buddha actually called perception, in his similes, he actually called perception the mirage, because it just creates this image for the mind, this name. And by creating that name, by choosing just one of the possible perceptions, it's disregarding all the rest, all the other possibilities. And that's what it's presenting to the mind, a half-truth. Not even a half-truth, a fractional truth. You know, you can look upon sort of a sunset, this is really beautiful. That's the perception which arises. There's many more aspects to that sunset which aren't beautiful. You look upon the meditation retreats, what are you going to call it? What perception is going to come up? There's only one perception can come up, and all those other perceptions are disregarded at that one moment of consciousness. Once you understand perception as a mirage, a very vague mirage, that you'll never take it to be anything serious. Certainly you will not take it to be a self. Not anything so vague, uncertain, so deceitful as being part of you. You can view your partner one day as someone who's so lovely and so wonderful, and you can hate their guts the next day. You can look upon Buddhism as being such a marvelous path one moment, the next moment you wonder why you ever were a Buddhist, or meditation. Perception is very unfaithful. So when you look at it very deeply, then every time you notice the view of taking that which is called perception to be a self or to be mine, it just doesn't hold water, doesn't wash, as they say. It cannot be so. And you disregard perception from that which you take to be a self, to be mine. It's one less thing that you're worried about, you detach from it, you're not so concerned with it. It's just something which arises according to causes and passes away according to causes. It's just a function of the activity of consciousness, no more, no less. And it's not me, it's not mine, it's not a self. It's certainly not the atta, the essential soul, the activity of perception. The activity of perception is very close to that which we call the activity of consciousness, because the activity of consciousness, one of its main functions is to perceive, right, to choose from the experience some aspect of it, so that it can present it to the mind and can know it, can make sense out of it, can actually be conscious of it. So that activity of consciousness and perception is very closely linked. And so often people mistake consciousness to be me, to be mine, to be a self. Very often, when I start to say the investigation of what do I take myself to be, Very often, one takes oneself to be that which knows, that which is conscious, that which feels the bite of the mosquito, that which feels the bliss of jhana, that which is on the receiving end of sensory experience. The very fact you start to say receiving end of sensory experience shows that there is an unnecessary assumption made that there is like two ends of sensory experience, the object and the subject. And if you look very carefully and investigate that, you see that's really not necessary. That's just a mistake of using language. You cannot really say that it is a subject doing the object. There is just a verb happening. The basic unit of experience, as Professor Warder once said, he was like a philologist, someone who studied languages and words. The basic unit of experience is a sentence, not a noun. An experience is an activity, it's a relationship. And when we split it up into subject and object, it is just an inference. It's just it's an abstraction from reality. If you actually look upon experience as it happens, it is just a sensing. It is a seeing, a hearing, a cognizing. It is not something cognizing that. It is not I think, therefore I am. It is just thinking. It's another thought which arises and passes away. No more, no less. And if you look very closely and analyze it with Yonistha Manasikara, you can see that consciousness is an activity. Conscious experience arises and passes away. And there's nobody doing it. There's no one at the receiving end of it. That is an assumption which, if one investigates clearly, that one can eradicate. If one does so, then one does not take to be a self, or one does not take to be a self that which cognizes, that which sees, that which knows, that which feels. That is an assumption which is a delusion. When that is seen to be an illusion, then you've overcome what I usually call like half the citadel of the self, where it truly hangs out, the citadel where its deepest home is in that which is conscious. We assume that to be me. And if you look upon it, you can see that cannot be you. One reason the Buddha said it cannot be you is because consciousness arises and passes away. Why? If it was somebody being conscious, the consciousness would not just pass away. It's one of the reasons that if one goes into the cessation of consciousness in the state of Nirodha after the eighth jhana, after the fourth immaterial jhana, when everything ceases, including consciousness and perception, then one understands the result of that, that consciousness cannot be a self. Because the self cannot be ceasing. Nor can consciousness belong to a self. It's not something which a self does or owns, because if it did, you could control this consciousness. I'm only going to be conscious of those senses which provide me with pleasure. And if, for example, that during my meditation, I'm only going to be conscious of like beautiful thoughts. And when the mosquitoes bite me, I'm not going to be conscious of that. Can you do that? Can you control your consciousness? Not even the Buddha could control his consciousness to the point that he could avoid all painful physical feeling. Sure, you can do it for a while, you can create the causes where consciousness stays on one of the jhana objects, but you can't do that forever. There's a limit to what you can do. If there's a limit to what you can do, rationally, reasonably, it cannot be yours, it cannot be belong to you, your possession. And the last citadel of the self is the will. And this is part of the sankharas. This is part of the mental activities. It is part of that which you investigate in the third satipatthana. Part of the mind, the thought, the citta. If you start to investigate very deeply, what do I take myself to be? What do I take as mine? Then if it's not that which is consciousness in the deepest level, it will be that which wills, that which chooses, that which decides, that which causes the shot, calls the shots. And once you can see what will is, and you can see it acting, you can see its activity, you apply sustained mindfulness on that, on the will, and you do not have any five hindrances which as it were trying to corrupt your mindfulness, trying to say look at it this way to try and make you see what's not really there, but to see it like with this open mind, with this clarity, to see what it truly is, not what you want it to be. The word I was looking for. The hindrances make you see what you want it to be, what you hope it to be, what you have a vested interest in it being. When the hindrances are gone, you see it as it is, truthfully, whether it hurts or not, whether you like it or not, whether it shocks you or not, whether it makes you know that you were wrong before or not. When the five hindrances are gone, there's no pride to cover up the truth. You see deeply into the true nature. And if you manage to sustain your attention on this process which we call will choosing, then you soon uncover the fact that this is not a self, this is not mine, that the will arises and passes away according to causes outside of a self, outside of a me or mine. One sees indeed there is no driver in the front seat of the bus. There is no one driving this. This is on a very complicated and complex causal chain. So many things coming together which make you choose this and not that. Which makes you choose to scratch, to think, or not to think. To come or to go. Why does this occur? Is it truly a self doing this? Or is it just a causal sequence? If you apply sustained mindfulness free of the hindrances, you uncover the causal sequence of will. And it shocks you again to the root to see that even that which appears as will, the mirage of will, the mirage which appears to the unenlightened consciousness as there's someone in there doing this. That appearance is uncovered, one goes behind the curtain and sees there's no one pulling the strings. It's causes, which are impersonal causes. Once that is seen, then you've explored the whole territory of the mind. You've explored feeling, perception, all of the mental activities, especially of thought and will. The Buddha actually pointed out in the sutta that chaitanya, will, is the most important of the mental activities. The reason is so that you can develop the investigation of will to uncover the one of the, what I call the two citadels, where the illusion of self hangs out. That which was the illusion, you find out what it truly is. Choice or will is real. Consciousness is real. The mirage is real, but we see it in a way which is not true. We mislabel it, misunderstand it. That's what we mean by illusion. It's not there's nothing there. Consciousness is there. Will is there. Only instead of seeing it as a self or belonging to a self, we see it just as an empty process. Once that happens, once you've explored the whole of conscious experience, the whole of mind, all its territory, and you found that each part of this that you cannot take to be a self, you cannot take to belong to me. When you've gone to the very heart of the mind and you see not even this is a self, not even this is mine, the enlightenment experience comes up. There is no self, but there is nothing belonging to me. When everything has been found to be not me, not mine, then that is the conclusion which arises. When that conclusion arises, it strikes you just for how many, not years, how many lifetimes, how many eons, one has taken this illusion to be something other than it is. That one is actually, at the deepest level of mind, one has assumed a self. And straight away one realizes the consequences of that illusion. The consequence of that illusion was called craving. Craving for pleasure and craving even to be, to exist. Once that illusion is uncovered, the craving disappears. When there's no self, there's no need to crave, there's no need to possess, there's no need to desire. One just sees this process, which we call body and mind, arising and passing away according to causes. One becomes a passenger in life rather than a driver. Someone who's serene rather than someone who gets upset. The truth of anatta has been uncovered, and it shocks, because one never expected the driver's seat to be empty. In fact, one can't conceive how a driver's seat can be empty and the bus keeps on going. Once one actually sees this, one understands how the process works. Tomorrow night I wanted to give more detail on how the process works, and it's called dependent origination. We're really going to test you tomorrow night. Test me as well, because it's a hard thing to explain. However, it uncovers the investigations. What do I take to be a self? In the realm of the mind, the five khandhas, the four satipatthanas, that this uncovers the truth, the heart, to see what the Buddha saw. Once that is seen, there is no one in there. The idea of cessation doesn't become so repugnant anymore. There's no one in there anyway, so actually nothing is being lost. So allowing this process to come to its final end and cessation, why not? The response becomes. And in fact, that it becomes quite a relief for the process to know that it doesn't have to keep on doing this forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Eternity is the biggest hell there can be. That something can go on forever, because there can be no relief, no peace. And you understand why the Buddha equated Nibbana with Sabbe Sankara Samatha, the stilling of all the activity which we call mind and body. the stilling of consciousness, the stilling of mental activity, the stilling of perception, feeling, the stilling of body, the ending of all attachment to this activity, which actually keeps it going, the ending of destruction of craving, which is the petrol which keeps this whole thing going, cessation, nibbana, the going out of the flame. The flame is just the flame, wasn't it, self? When you've got no vested interest in the flame, no sense of self, you are able to let it go out. The meteor in the sky finally hitting the truth, and a blaze of light disappearing into dust. This journey over, the end, enlightenment. So this is the investigation into non-self. It's incredibly subtle. It takes courage. It takes a dedication to truth, to find the truth at all costs, even though it hurts, even though you're going to lose something. And the Buddha gave a little carrot to say, actually, it's not all that bad being enlightened. Actually, cessation is the highest happiness there can ever be. Nibbanam paramang sukhang. Nibbana is the highest bliss. To understand that, you have to know anatta. To understand anatta, you have to use this investigation, the Yoni Samana Sikara, which goes to the source of the illusion of self, the idea of self. To go to that source, you would do well to use the tool. What do I take myself to be? What do I take myself to be? What do I take myself to be? In the realm of body, in the realm of mind, following the five khandhas, the description of the territory of body and mind which the Buddha gave. They're very useful designations to really get to grips with what we mean by mind. And it's very easy to see that there cannot be anything beyond the five khandhas. It takes up everything which one can see as conscious experience. That which one cannot experience is just fantasy, just speculation. Be careful not to get lost in positing things which you cannot experience. If you cannot experience it, it's tantamount to saying it does not exist. And that investigation, if it is fueled by samadhi, if it is facilitated by the lack of the five hindrances, if it is accompanied with mindfulness, sustaining that mindfulness, inquiring and not stopping until you find the truth, no matter what that truth means, then you have the means and the ability to gain the enlightenment experiences, see what the Buddha saw, and understand the profundity of that which he called the Dhamma. So that's the Dhamma discourse for this evening on anatta. If you haven't understood it, I wouldn't sort of worry too much about it. It's putting this in one's mind so later on, when the conditions are right, one actually does see, follow this inquiry, and to see the profound, blissful, ego-shattering experience of seeing the Dhamma. So has anyone got any questions or comments about this talk this evening? Yes.
A question about Nibbana being the highest bliss. I can understand that somebody on this side who's still in a state of carrying around, lugging around his body, could say through their perception that cessation is bliss, but if somebody dies, Buddha or an Arahant, how can you call something bliss if there's nobody there to define it as such?
That's a very good question. And that was asked by the monk who died in Admiral Sariputta in very similar words. So that your question appeared to one of the great monks at the time. How can you call enlightenment the highest happiness, this monk asked, when in enlightenment, in Nibbana, in cessation, there is no consciousness and no perception? And Venerable Sariputta gave the following simile, which indicates the nature of sukha and dukkha, of happiness and suffering, and why Nibbana is the highest happiness. He said it's like a person who is sick with an illness. When they recover from that illness, when that illness disappears and is no longer there, they feel happy. Why do they feel happy? They feel happy because an affliction has disappeared. And he said, and when a person who is like healthy, enjoying their life, finds and enters the first jhana, they feel greater happiness. Why is that? And Sariputta replied, this is Sariputta asking his own questions and replying to them. The reason is because the person in first jhana understands an affliction has ceased. The affliction of the mind being concerned with the five senses. When a person leaves the first jhana and enters the second jhana, why is it even greater happiness? Because an affliction has been let go of. The affliction of vitakka vichara, the working of the mind, which we usually know as thought. When you go into third jhana, it's greater happiness. Why? Because an affliction has been let go of. What is that affliction? Rapture. Very few people know that rapture is an affliction. Rapture is just so blissful. However, if you let go of it, it's like, again, the tadpole going out of water. The person born in prison, raised in prison, brought up in prison, grown up in prison, don't know it's prison. When they leave it, only then do they realize, hey, that was prison. That was an affliction. From third jhana to fourth jhana is greater happiness. Why? Because an affliction of happiness, of sukha, has been let go of, and equanimity is more delightful. And as one goes into the immaterial jhanas, just before one goes into cessation, the experience which they call neither perception nor non-perception is let go of. That is realized to be an affliction. One realizes that perception and consciousness is an affliction, and its letting go is the ultimate happiness. And that's the explanation of Venerable Sariputta. In that way, Venerable Udayan, you can know that Nibbana, cessation, is the highest happiness, in the understanding it's an ending of an affliction.
That's not by what it is, but what it is not, that you know that it's bliss.
This is a very profound understanding of what dukkha is. It's understanding that all the five khandhas, in any way, form, type of expression, a conscious experience, if looked at deeply, is an affliction. If you know, if you see Nibbana, if you see cessation, that you know that the ending of the five khandhas is the highest happiness. That is a very difficult thing for a person to get their mind around. Logically, it can be seen that because the attachment to existence is called bhava dhanha, it's one of the very deep-seated attachments which the human being has, which keeps us on samsara. We'd rather be something than nothing, no matter what that something is, even if it's painful, rather than disappear altogether. And it's the attachment of self which creates the attachment to existence, bhava dhanha. And to understand that, one can get great understanding through doing jhanas, because one can see that what one took to be happiness, great happiness, actually was suffering. This is a delusion of happiness. Bhava Dhanha is the craving for existence, the craving to be, which creates the will to be. And that craving to be is one of the most powerful things which creates rebirth. When one dies, one still wants to be. And that creates the continuation of the mind and body. You give up that will to continue, and then you cease. That's a profound question. Thank you for asking me that. You do not hope to understand it fully, but maybe get a smell, a taste of the answer. Yes, sure.
Depends on one stage to the next and being able to look back and see that something was wrong, and then they go to the next stage and they see that something's wrong. But the final
stage depends on the person not being there.
How it can be
because the person is seen from the very beginning as not being there.
Certainly not painful.
No, this again, the problem comes with trying to understand this from the viewpoint of self. I remember I did mention earlier when I sometime in this talk that the only way you can understand dukkha and to understand that the cessation of the five khandhas is the ending of dukkha is to first of all penetrate to the truth of non-self. Otherwise it's just completely incomprehensible. Precisely the reason you said, how can, like, cessation, when there's no consciousness, when there's no one to know it's happy, how can that be happiness? Mm-hmm. Well, there's no one here now, can you experience happiness? That is the asking for the tape. What is here now? That is like the investigation which you have to do first. So you have to do the investigation in anatta first before you have a hope of understanding the meaning of why cessation is the ultimate happiness. So you can't do second what you have to do first. It has to be done in an order. And it's why the Buddha kept on saying that it's so difficult to teach this Dhamma, because people will not understand, they will not be able to see from this side, you know, of the stream. On the other side, you can sort of understand why it's the highest happiness. So, the path, what one has to do first of all is maybe having a little bit of trust or a little bit of width that this maybe makes some sort of sense, that to do the investigation into anatta. Because whether cessation is the highest happiness or not, you can put that on the back burner. The important question which the Buddha said do first of all is what do you take yourself to be? Now. Not in cessation. But, you know, just as you're asking this question, as you're holding your head in your hand, you know, what is the self? And to be able to do that inquiry, you have to do something previous, which is to train the mind. So it's strong, so it's powerful, so it can put aside its vested interests of desire and aversion, the first two hindrances, so that you're not going to muddy the waters by any vested interests in the judgment. It's like choosing a jury, choosing a judge to try a case. If that judge or jury has any vested interest in the outcome of the investigation, it's going to be a corrupt investigation. It's not going to get at the truth. You have to have impartial investigators. The impartiality is guaranteed by the absence of the five hindrances. Five hindrances being there, it will always be impartial. The absence of the five hindrances means impartiality. in your investigation. And this takes you to this realization. And this is like the realization of the Buddha, which you can read about in the suttas. And this is the realization which the Arahats talk about, if you read about it in the books. Which, when we read about it, when you read about it first of all, hang on, this doesn't make sense. But fortunately, there's much else which does make sense, which gives you confidence to maybe put this on the back burner. And let's do the practices, let's do the strengthening exercises. And then we can actually see whether it's true or not. It's like saying that is, say, like years ago, centuries ago, they said that the source of the Nile was in this amazing waterfall called Victoria Falls. Many people didn't believe that. Sort of incomprehensible. But then we said, okay, well, to find out, this is what you've got to do. You've got to travel there. It's a lot of work. And when they travel, they're, hey, it's true, there is such a thing. You know, or like to the people of 400, 500 years ago, they thought the world was flat. It was completely incomprehensible, beyond their conceptual language, to think of the world as round. But then, you know, someone went round the world and proved it. It takes like the effort to change one's worldview, the way one perceives, the way one thinks, the way one views. You know, it's a strange thing. Once one views the world as flat, you find the perceptions justify that, and you, even the thoughts, actually you see it as flat. It's quite obvious that the world is flat, isn't it? You know, it's sort of, you can see that direction is flat, that direction is flat, that direction is flat. I remember talking to some villagers in Thailand when I first went there. They were very simple villagers, and they thought the world was flat, because, you know, they asked, you know, I don't know if it was asked me or one of the monks, you know, where do you come from? And I said, oh, I come from America. Where's that? You know, just to be like a smart aleck, he said, in that direction, pointing downwards. And this poor villager was scratching his head, no, it can't be in that direction. It's either that way or that way or that way or that way. And actually, their perception and their thoughts and their views was the world is flat. Because, you know, if you haven't been told it and taught it, or, you know, or seeing pictures of the Earth from a space shuttle, that's how it seems. And it seemed that way to intelligent people for centuries, for millennia, just as the way it seems to intelligent people for lifetimes that there is a self here. It seems that there is, that the very idea of cessation free happiness is just complete ridiculous.
Possibly it's okay to think that the cosmos is a pan-dimensional being that we cannot contemplate, and it's similar to talking about America being in that direction, trying to talk about beginnings and ends in this context. We're probably talking about something you can't really talk about.
Well, you gave an example of maybe. This is just like an example, I understand from your statement, that maybe this whole world is some pan-dimensional being which we can never really understand. The point is, with the Buddha's past enlightenment, it can be verified. It can be experienced.
But not in an ordinary way,
in a very specialized way, but it can be experienced. So it is not just a mere speculation, which you can never know. It's not ineffable, but it can be tested, which makes it different than, like, say, a Christian idea of a God which you can never really know about, not through any way whatsoever. The Buddha was saying, oh, this is what I found, this is what you can find. And the way of finding out, the way of the inquiry, is so appealing because it makes so much rational sense, that one at least can know that from the amount of meditation and reflection which we've all done, that the mind can be illusory when five hindrances are there, and that there are possibilities which you can experience in meditation which really do extend your understanding of consciousness and perception and its range. and you can feel the power of the mind when you do gain concentration, and you can understand that maybe with so much power you can go much further into the truth. And the Buddha said, yeah, go into the truth. And he wasn't really saying to you what you will find there, he was saying what you should how you should search. He gave you the plans, he gave you the route map. And he was saying actually that the experience of Nibbana, like the experience of jhanas, is however you expect it to be, you'll be something different. This is beyond your present experience. And these are subtle states which, however you imagine it to be, will be something else, because at the moment there's not even a language there to describe it to yourself. So that's why that sometimes it baffles the mind to try and understand enlightenment when you haven't, first of all, uncovered the anatta doctrine. It becomes impossible, and you just go get yourself in a mess and go crazy and go scratching your head till it hurts. So the Buddha said, anatta first of all. And at least you can get some whiff, some glimpse of what that means. This is not an easy thing. This is challenging. If the teaching told you what you already know, what sort of sits comfortably with you, it wouldn't be worth very much. This is taking you a little bit further. Yes, Diane? That's an interesting one. You say, well, if this is all like just a causally conditioned activities, then we really don't have any choice whether we're on this path or not. What you say is accurate. We really do not have any choice to come on this retreat or not. However, it appears that we have a choice. And we're running on appearances. We're running on appearances. Like a choice. I mean, you chose to say that. At least that's how it appeared, wasn't it? But did you really choose? Mm-hmm. You know the simile I gave a few days ago? And it's a very powerful simile. It's perhaps the most indicative one, which shows the illusion of choice. It's another one about the hypnotist. You hypnotize someone to, I think yesterday I said, to drop their trousers. Say they'd like to do a cartwheel. After the talk at 9:30, that when I scratch my nose, I'd hypnotize, say, one of the people here. At that signal, scratching my nose, you'd come in front here and do a cartwheel in front of the altar. And then I'd sing the Australian National Anthem. And it's funny. And you can hypnotize someone to do that. And you say that after the you hypnotize him, you give them a suggestion, you won't remember anything about this hypnosis. And I scratch my nose and they do that, and you ask them afterwards, you know, why did you do that? To them it will appear that they chose to do that cartwheel and sing the national anthem. And it surprises them to realize that that which appeared so clearly to them to be a free choice, they choose to do that, not to do that, was in fact not their choice at all. It shakes them. It shakes them, their belief that they are doing the choosing. And it shakes the whole belief in that which we call choice or will as being mine, me doing it. And that's actually quite shocking, because that has tremendous consequences.